continue the discussion of gauge fixing in non-abelian gauge series. And last lecture was quite mathematical. In fact, I just had time to introduce the tools. But now we are going to use that, and you'll see that it's quite natural in this a bit abstract language to see what's happening. Okay, so remember, we have a gauge series. So we have gauge potentials, A, mu. And we have gauge transformation, so we can, let's write this in a very sketchy form. A goes to AG, which is G A plus D mu G minus 1, where A are gauge potentials. Gauge potentials, they belong to the algebra of the group. For each, there are functions, but each, the value of the gauge potential at one point are elements of the Lie algebra of the group. So for SU2, these are the usual Hermitian traceless matrices. And G is a gauge, it's a group function, so it's a belong to the group G. So it's a, and this is a gauge transformation. Okay. And we have seen that we have this big space of, which is a space of A. It's the space of all functions of gauge potential over space and time. And we have the orbits of the under the group G, so G belongs to, so this is a gauge function, so this is function for the group, orbits of G, acting for a given A. For a given A, you have A and AG. And those are physically equivalent physical configurations that describe the same physics. So in order to quantize properly, we have to enforce gauge fixing condition. Okay. And gauge fixing amounts to choose. So gauge fixing choice. So that's a free choice. Well, a free choice we can use different, and we need the same physics, amounts to enforce that some function of A is equal to zero, where f is a functional, that maps gauge field onto element of the Lie algebra. So you have three gauge fixing condition instead of one, if you are if you are on SU3. So remember, each A mu belongs to the Lie algebra, so they are vector potential. These are functions, so functions which maps A into a function on the Lie algebra. So that's a very compact way. Yes.
Why the FA is a Lie algebra function?
Why?
Because it is I think it's Lie algebra tensor Lie algebra, because it is a matrix.
Yeah, it's, no, but my language is maybe not precise enough. It was just reminders. You see, A mu, A is a collection of A mu.
Yeah, A is Lie algebra function.
Yeah. But for, and but each, so this means that you have some A mu A of X. Okay, and each f is just, so f of a means some f a of x. So you have one function,
yes,
you have three functions, x, and this is a functional of the a mu, let's p, of the derivative of a mu b in general, etc. because, for instance, for the Lorentz gauge or the Coulomb gauge, depend not only on the value of gauge potential, but of the derivative. So it's a functional of A mu. So this is functional of the A mu A of x that maps into a function on x on the Lie algebra. Function from M4 into the Lie algebra. So that's the compact way. That's what we did. Okay. Basically, this just says that you have, at each point in space-time, you have three gauge fixing conditions. Okay. And so now we start. So now let's see how we gauge fix. So how we reduce a path integral. The question is, can we reduce a big path integral with a big measure over all the space of all gauge field configuration onto an integral over A, D of A, but I'm writing this in a very compact form, delta of F of A. So I enforce that at each point in space-time, x, this F and each A, F A of x is equal to zero. So how do we enforce that and what has to be taken here in order to have a well-defined condition? And so the principle is quite, you know, now we have everything in order to do that. So first, let's consider, well, let's inverse that. So let's consider that I have my big space, and for each, I draw again this picture. This is my orbit. This is my gauge fixing condition, F of A equals zero here. On this slice, and let me consider some A somewhere. So you see, for any A, so any gauge field configuration, you see, there is some gauge transformation that send it on the gauge slice. You see, so there is a some G, some element of the gauge, of the big gauge rope. There is a G belonging to A, to G, let's say. So I'm right using some mathematical notation. There is an element, so there is a gauge transformation that maps this into with my notation. That maps A into A0, which is such that F of A0 equals zero. This is A, this is A0. So of course this A0 is AG, is AG for some G. So this G, let's denote it G of A. You see. Of course, this G of A depends on the gauge condition. So there is a G A. There is a gauge transformation that maps A onto the gauge slice. So let's call this G of A. So G of A, of course, depends on A and on the gauge fixing given by F. But let's consider a choice of F. So we choose a F. First, we choose a F. Okay. And well, in my notes, in fact, the fact that it depends on F is written that that's a GA of F. So we can denote it the f of a. See, so it's both a function which is a functional of a and a functional of f. So it starts to be a bit abstract. But let's okay. Okay. So now we start from this. You see, we start from our original big integral. Integral over the space of all gauge configuration, d of a. And for each a, let's add 1, the number 1, but writing with a trick that I explained yesterday, that's a trick, which is integral over all gauge transformation. So I write this d of g, that's an integral over all gauge field. And this is an integral over all gauge transformation, okay, with a delta function of g minus g of a. So here I integrate over all the g's, but I pick up in this big integral over all the g's just by a delta function the g that sends j to g of a. So I've done nothing. Yes?
Sorry. Could you please explain again why there are three gauge fixing conditions?
Because there are three generators for the gauge transformation. It's just that. So you can make three independent gauge transformation for SU2. And so you have to fix. You have to gauge fix to make a gauge function for each of those independent gauge transformation. In Maxwell's theory, you have only one possible gauge transformation. You have one generator of U1. So you need only one gauge condition at each point. Okay. For instance, for the since we have now some A mu of A, which depend on space and time, remember X is T and X. The analog of the Lorentz gauge. You have three of them. It's just this. If you impose only one, you have only fixed partially the gauge. Okay. Okay. So the trick is to. So this is a trick. It seems to be. This is the trick. We rewrite one as an integral over the big gauge group of the integral over all gauge transformation, but we choose a gauge transformation which send A onto the gauge slice. See? Okay. And then we use the trick that we had here. G of A is the solution of the gauge condition of A, G of A, equals zero. You see? It's the element of G, which is such that F of A of G is equal to zero. So it's the solution of, let's say, that. So if f of a of g is equal to zero, this gives that g equals the g of a. Okay.
In that integral, that g is the g of gauge group or the g of?
No, it's an integral over the gauge group.
Over the group.
Integral over. So basically, you know, d of g means products of all points in space time. You see? Of the d mu of g of x, where this is the r measure on the group G, which is in our case SU2. So the R measure has some there is formulas and some book. I won't need this the explicit formula, but it's well defined. So you see. So this is an integral over all gauge transformation. The space of gauge transformation is of course smaller than the space of gauge potential. Otherwise, you could fix completely the gauge. And there will be no degrees of freedom. Okay, so G of A is just the solution of this equation. So now we can use the trick that we did, I explained yesterday, as how to write to transform this into a delta of f of g. You see? So this means that I can rewrite this integral as, let's write it. So now, integral of d of a over the space of gauge potential. I get an integral over d g, an integral over the space of gauge transformation. And I rewrite this as the delta function of f of a of g. It's a shortened notation for saying that for all x and all a, d mu a mu a of x is equal to zero. So it's a delta of this quantity. You see, it means this products for all a, all x of this. But of course, if I go from this to this, I have to multiply by the Jacobian. I have to multiply by the absolute value of the determinant of the Jacobian, which we can write schematically. This is very compact notation. The determinant of the Jacobian matrix, which is the partial derivative of the gauge fixing function, when you vary g. You see? And that's just an explanation of what we did. So let me explain precisely what this is. So this is, as I explained, this can be just is products over x, all points in space-time, on Minkowski four-dimensional. Products over all A from 1 to 3 for SU2 of delta of FA AG of X. Okay. So that's the explicit condition you have. For each X and each A, you have a gauge fixing condition FA of X, which depends on the gauge field. So I write this delta function as a product of delta function for each of the conditions. Okay, so now, what is this? Well, we just have to remember what we did yesterday in the particular case of, so taking the derivative means what's happened when we make a change of transformation. So we consider this, what is f prime? We consider a gauge fixing condition, which our case is going to be dFA of A, when I make a small infinitesimal transformation of G. So I change the group element G into the group element G, 1 plus I times an element of the Lie algebra. An element of the Lie algebra. So I make an infinitesimal gauge transformation. Okay, so and remember, alpha is alpha A, so alpha is alpha of X. So alpha means the collection of alpha of X equal alpha A of X, TA. So that's a short notation for a function from X onto the Lie algebra, which has three components, alpha A of X. Okay, so I write this. I evaluate this for a given point x, and I take the what's happening when alpha, when the variation, I vary the component alpha b of y at a different point y. So this is this object, which is a kernel of a differential operator, is what I'm calling f prime a g. And you see, this is in fact a matrix in the Lie algebra, so it's a 3x3 matrix. It depends on the point x and the point y, because you take the gauge condition at a given point x and you make a variation, gauge transformation, at a given point y. So it's a derivative of the gauge fixing with respect to gauge transformation. And it's just a generalization of what we did, okay? And so that's the definition. And so, well, let's forget about this. So you see, this is, if you forget of the A of G, so this is a 3x3 matrix, which is a kernel on M4 of some linear operator acting on function of x and y, because it depends both on x and y. So, yes?
The determinant is taken with respect to x and y, or to
no, we take it to respect to everything. So, you see, this object, let's write it in my lecture note, I write it more simply as g of x, y, and it depends on the Lie algebra indices A and B, you see. So this is a kernel of what? This is a kernel operator that taking, if you take a function psi of y, which is given by a collection of psi b of y, or y belonging to M4. So this psi is a function, so psi is a function from Minkowski space onto the Lie algebra, because it has its component at three. This kernel f prime of A, you see f prime of A is a linear operator acting on this function. On those function psi, the function from M4 into the Lie algebra. And it acts in the following way. You take a function psi of y, and this f prime of a applied on psi is another function. Let's call it phi, okay? Which of course has is given by a matrix element phi a of x, with x belonging to M4 and A going from 1 to 3. And phi A of x is just the integral over y of the g x y. And you should not forget the indices A and B, psi b of y. So that's just a standard definition of the kernel of a linear operator. but this operator acts on functions with value in the algebra. So the function carry indices. Okay, so that's just the standard definition of a kernel. So this is the act. This defines the action kernel. Okay. And so now, so we get that our green function is now we have transformed this. Our path integral with this. You see? So we have now a delta function on the gauge fixing condition and a value of a determinant of some operators. We are going to discuss this operator in a few minutes. But before that, we must do one last thing. Last step. Use gauge invariance. Because we have not used, we have not been using gauge invariance at all here. We have just introduced one written as some delta function of something and written. So we have not yet used gauge invariance. Using gauge invariance means simply invert the integration. So rewrite this as integral over the space of all gauge transformation. V of G, then an integral over the space of all gauge field configuration. See? And then I have this delta of F of A of G times the absolute value of the determinant of this operator, a click of function, which is written schematically of f prime of a of g. Okay? And so we invert the integration. Okay? And of course, you must remember that somewhere you have exponential of I over h, well, I times the Young-Mills action of the gauge field A. But because of gauge invariance, this, we can replace it by AG. Any gauge transformation doesn't change the Young-Mills action. So we can replace this by exponential of I S Young-Mills of AG inside the integral over A. The idea is you integrate over A and then you integrate over G. So you replace A by A of G in the action and then in the integral, and then we have to use also the fact that, so we use the fact too. We use the fact that S of A Young-Mills is equal to S of AG. And we have also to use the invariance of the measure, namely that D of A is equal to D of AG. So we have to use the fact that we assume that both the action and the measure are gauge invariant. Otherwise, we wouldn't be dealing with a gauge invariant quantity. So invariance, this is a load and the measure. So AG in the action and the measure. In the measure. And that's where gauge invariance is crucial. So we replace, okay? And second step, then, now we have AG here. and we have AG here. So you see, everything depends on AG instead of A. Yes?
I thought that the measure was like all possible A's, all possible gauge fields, but.
Yes. Yes, it is. But the point is that the measure is invariant under gauge transformation. You see? The measure, if you take a little element here, let me write it again here. You have your space of gauge transformation. This is the space A. This is a gauge transformation. If you take a little volume element in the space of gauge field, it has some volume. You transform it by a gauge transformation, any gauge transformation. The volume is unchanged. This is what means gauge invariance of the measure.
But didn't we like fix our gauge? So
what is it?
Don't we want to fix our gauge? So why do we want the volume element to still be invariant under this transformation?
No, that we started from an integral. At the first step here, we started from a big integral where we integrate over everything. You see, and we want to reduce this to an integral over this. And that's what we are doing. Up to the moment, I am still integrating over all the A's. But still, now I have a delta function. So the second step is change. So remember, now we integrate over the gauge transformation, and then we integrate over the A. So as long as we don't integrate over the G's inside this subintegral, we can change a variable. We can change of variables. We can rewrite this as integral over A.
That's what making change variable is.
This is a dummy. I'm sorry. This is a dummy variable. AG is a dummy variable because we integrate over it. So we can rewrite this as integral over G. So we integrate over A gauge field transformation, and inside we integrate over all possible A, over all gauge field, D of A, delta of F of A, determinant of F prime of A, exponential of I S, action, Yagi's action of A. You see, so this big functional integral is equal to this. Okay? And here, you see that now the integral of a G is completely separated over the integral of the gauge field. So this is just a factor that comes out, which is independent of Z. So you see that Z is just this integral, what you can view at the volume of the group of gauge transformation, times integral d of a, delta of f of a, determinant of the matrix of the derivative of the gauge condition when you make a gauge transformation, with an absolute value, times exponential of I S Young-Mies of A. So this factors out. It's just a global factor. And this is the gauge fixed functional integral. Because you integrate over all A with a weight which is the exponential of the action, So it's a quantum theory. This delta takes care of the gauge fixing. So you keep only in the integral only the gauge potential which satisfies the gauge fixing condition. And in order to be sure that this is a gauge invariant, you must take into account this determinant. So this determinant is a factor that has to be taken into account when you integrate. Instead of integrating from this, you integrate over this in order to have something which is gauge invariant. So this is the famous Fadiyev-Popov determinant, the Feynman-DeWitt. Determinant which ensures gauge invariance. Okay? And this factors out. This factors out. So it won't be. When you compute correlation function of gauge invariant observable, this is divided between the numerator and the denominator. So it just. The change of the measure. You see? So this is the idea. And maybe I can say a last thing. You can see that when you're doing that, you have written like that, you have not changed your integration space. First you integrate over all space. This restricts in integrating over this. The gauge slice, but this integration over all gauge transformation takes into account the fact you integrate over all the orbits. So this is basically the volume of the orbits, and this is integration of the gauge slice. So you manage to separate the integration along the orbits from the integration over the gauge slice by this clever change of variable. Take into account this factor. So that's the idea. Of course, this is still very mathematical, but now, of course, what we have to do is to understand what this gives for a gauge theory, precise gauge theory. So now, what we have to do is do an explicit calculation. So that's the general framework, but we have to do some explicit calculation. So we consider SU2, as usual, and we consider the Lorentz, which is some kind of Lorentz-Landau gauge. So we enforce the choice that d mu a of x is equal to zero. You see? So this is our condition, f of a. This is f of a. Okay, so now we have to compute what is f prime of a. Yes?
Could you comment on that change of variable again?
Well, it's just that here, A of G is a dummy variable.
Right.
First, I choose a G and I compute this integral. You see? And this integral, in fact, doesn't depend on G because you integrate over all A of G. And everything is not independent of G. So you can, if you prefer, you rename A of G a tilde. And you have a tilde. And you integrate. And you get something which does not depend on G because everything is gauge invariant. So you get just a number. And so afterwards, you can integrate over all the gauge transformation. It just gives you some volume. And if instead of integrating just the partition function by integrating the exponential of the action, you had added here any gauge invariant observable, the gauge invariant observable will be there, and depending only on A. So you can add to this, let's call it constant W of A, some gauge invariant observable. Then you would have here W of A. Provided this is gauge invariant. Okay, so let me go. Still 5 minutes, so I think I have time to do the calculation. So now let me see what's happening where, in the case of the Lorentz gauge. Well, in fact, there is a small but clever, as usual, additional modification of the Lorentz gauge, which is due to Feynman, which is to add some function, let's call it what is called epsilon A of X equal 0. So this is F of A. Well, epsilon is just some function. You choose a function of x, three function of x, but fixed function, they are just, and you enforce that d mu of a mu of a is equal to this function. So it's, so for epsilon equals 0, this is just Lorentz gauge. Okay, that's a classical. Okay. So this is our function. This means that f mu fa f of a of x is this. To, for a given a, you have a functional whose value f, the component a of fa at point x is this function. It involves just the derivative of a. Okay. So now, let's perform an infinitesimal gauge transformation. So what is an infinitesimal gauge transformation? So an infinitesimal gauge transformation means that I change a mu a of x onto a mu a of x plus the covariant derivative of a mu of some alpha of x. X A. So a gauge transformation generated by some alpha A of x. So this is the generator of an infinitesimal gauge transformation. Remember, which is, of course, we have seen that this is d mu, this is a mu of x, a mu a of x, plus d mu of alpha a of x, plus the commutator of alpha with a. So for SU2, this is just epsilon A B C alpha C of X. So this is the structure constant of SU2, the commutator of two matrices, remember? Okay. This term is absent when you for Maxwell theory. And this term, I'm sorry. And of course, I'm very sorry, there is there is an A mu B. So there is a B here, let's say. A mu B of X epsilon C of X. Alpha. So this is a gauge transformation on A mu, and it's nonlinear. Okay. So now let's write what is f of this. So this is A mu plus the variation. So what is f of this A mu A prime of X? F of A prime A of X. Well, this is just the ordinary A mu tilde of X. This is just, well, the ordinary term plus the variation. So it's just F A of X plus D mu applied to this. So this is plus D mu, the ordinary derivative applied to D mu alpha, and we take the component A of X, and we take the component A of X. You see? So this is a variation. And this is, this term is nothing but, so that's a term interesting. So this term is, well, the ordinary derivative, so it's d mu of alpha A of X. This is the ordinary Laplace operator. Okay, plus a new term, plus epsilon A B C D mu, well, D mu with an index, an upper index of applied on A mu B of X alpha C of X. Okay? And therefore, so this is this. Let me turn in that. And this coefficient is the operator f prime. When I make a variation of alpha, I get this. So this means that f prime of A, this means that, you see, this is an operator. So this can be written as, this can be written as, nabla applied to alpha A plus, so I'm going to write this, nabla delta AC, because if I have an, and here I'm writing alpha C of X, so this is delta AC d mu, this is the ordinary Laplacian, plus epsilon A B C, and then I have two operators. First, I can apply the derivative to alpha C, so then I have A mu B X times D mu applied to alpha C, but I can also have epsilon A B C D mu of A mu B of X, that's a function, times alpha C of X. So we see, So this is derivative with respect to if, this is derivative with respect to x. Derivative to x here, and this is a derivative with respect to x. So you see that. And this is the operator f prime of a. It's an operator which acts on functions in the Lie algebra and maps them on functions. Okay. So this is this operator, f prime of a, whose kernel is g. So the kernel, you see, the Fadiyev Popov operator is a differential operator. Acting on functions in the Lie algebra. It is this operator, this one. Okay? And this differential operator contains ordinary Laplacian. So this differential operator, we can map it in, write it in a standard way. We can write it as delta AC, the Laplace operator, plus epsilon, let me write ABC, A, B times G mu. I contract the index mu and nu, so A mu D, if you want, plus epsilon A, B, C, dA B times alpha C. So this is Laplace operator. So it contains two derivative differential operator, one derivative and zero derivative multiplication by a function. Yes?
Sorry, the notation is not very clear here. The two derivative terms with the covariant derivative, that becomes this expression?
No. This is an ordinary derivative.
Yes. And we write it.
And this is a covariant derivative.
Right.
So in fact, this is the operator. This is the explicit expression for this is D times D.
So this
products of ordinary derivative by a covariant derivative. This is d mu a mu. So this is the most compact way to write the Fadiyev-Popov operator. Ordinary derivative applied to a covariant derivative. But that's more explicit because this shows how it depends on A. It depends on the gauge field.
I'm just asking if, like, this thing in the rectangle.
Yes.
Is that the equality, or is f of a?
No, it's an equality. It's just that I'm computing. So this is the effect of the gauge. So this is the effect of the gauge transformation. I compute how does the gauge condition vary when I applied a gauge transformation.
Yes, sorry, and just this epsilon ABC, the structure factor part, and the two derivatives becomes that expression over there.
Yes, it's just another way to, I have just rewritten this expression, and I consider that, you know, I consider that this is just this f prime of A, that's the definition. That's the operator f prime of A, applied to the function alpha, and this is a function from Minkowski space in the Lie algebra, so in terms of component, it has a component A. I am interested in the component A at a point X.
Why is there a delta AC in that?
Oh, just because since here I have an alpha A and I have an alpha A, and if here on the On the right, I won't put an alpha C. For this term, C is equal to A, so I just write delta AC. It's diagonal in the Lie algebra. But here you see this mixes the indices of alpha and the indices of B, because it's a commutator of alpha and of A. And the commutator is non-zero. Okay, so this is the, three different ways to rewrite this Fadeev-Popov operator we have to consider. Very compact way, this is covariant derivative times ordinary derivatives, component operator, and you see that it depends on A. And since it depends on A, it means that if in this functional integral you had forgotten it, this would not be the same functional integral. And you would have lost something. Okay? And I think it's time to make the pause. Well, one last measure. Of course, it depends on A because SU2 is not commutative. For the Maxwell theory, there is no commutator. This term is absent. And so, in fact, for the Maxwell theory, there is a Fadeev-Popov determinant, but it's a determinant of the ordinary Laplace operator, which doesn't depend on A. So it's a constant. So it's a constant, I can put it here too. So for ordinary U1 theory, this determinant is trivial. It's not zero, it's a number, but it's independent of A. So all what you did in QFT1 when quantizing the Maxwell field was correct, precisely because of this reason. Well, you can see it in the... So it's the interaction that draws this. Okay, so let's do the break. And after the break, I'll show you how this determinant can be represented in the functional integral by adding new fields, which are the famous Fadeev-Popov Gauss, because we're computing a determinant of a differential operator. Okay, so let's meet in 5 minutes. It's differential operator. Derivative times covariant derivative. Okay. And we want to write this determinant in a functional integral in a nice way. So first, you'll notice that this is the absolute value of the determinant. And you may say, okay, but there might be some region in configuration space where is my configuration space? You might have some region in configuration space where the determinant is positive and some region where it is negative. And this might be a real problem, but let's assume that in fact this doesn't occur. And there are some gauge choice where this doesn't occur. And if you are looking in the vicinity of the vacuum, where f mu nu equals zero, this doesn't occur. One can show that this doesn't occur. So if no sign changes, of course, the sign of the determinant can occur only if the determinant vanishes at some point. And if the determinant vanishes, it means that this Fadeev-Popov operator, this differential operator, has zero modes, which gives additional problems. So no sign changes, which is no zero modes. Okay. Then?
What do you mean by zero mode?
Why?
Why is it called zero mode?
It's mean because if you have a differential operator, if you have a differential operator, let's call it, I don't know, blah. If you have a, if the determinant of this operator is zero, it means that you have some function psi such that delta of psi is equal to zero. So this is a zero mode. I mean, besides the trivial zero mode, which is a constant phi. But you see here, as soon as A is different from zero, it's not clear that we have zero modes. OK, so we assume this. So that's an assumption, assume. But that's a good assumption. Then we have seen that in general, we can write this as the determinant. This determinant, we can write it as a fermionic integral over two field C bar and C exponential of C bar, this determinant F prime of A times C, where this has fields, Grassmann. Okay. We have seen that for Dirac field, where for Dirac field, the operator was the Dirac operator. Here, we don't have the Dirac operator. We have the Fadiyev-Popov operator. But it's also a differential operator. So this trick of Fadiyev and Popov, Popov is a very nice way to proceed. So for some reason, it's convenient since we are in the to introduce an I factor to have also an I factor in terms of the action. And we are going to call this the Fadiyev-Popov action.
Is there any reason we use Grassmann fields, or is it just convenience?
Well, it's a matter of it's going equivalent to compute this determinant by other way, but it's going to be a nice representation because when we are going to deal with what are the Feynman rules of the theory, we are going to have Feynman rules both for the gauge field and the fermionic field, and I'm going to show that in a minute. Okay. So this field C is called the ghost field, and C bar is going to be called the anti-ghost. But C bar is just the Grassmann conjugate of C. Okay. So now we have to think about what are those. So this is going to be an action, which I'm going to call the ghost part action, and is going to depend on C bar, on C, and on A, because the functional determinant becomes on A. Now, you have to think about, you see that the Fadiyev-Popov determinants maps element of the algebra into elements of the algebra. So the C is, in fact, a collection of generator CA of X. And the C bar has some C bar A of X. So the ghost and anti-ghost are functions. Each CA of X is a generator of a Grassmann algebra. And they carry charges, you see. They are anti-commuting field. They belong to the Lie algebra. They are anti-commuting functions from X into the Lie algebra, but with anti-commuting characters. Okay. And now, so they belong to the Lie algebra. So in the same way that the Dirac field are carrying Dirac indices, they belong to the algebra, they carry group algebra. A goes from 1, 2, to 3. So they carry charges. They do not. Okay. but they do not carry spin. But no spin. There is no mu indices. They are scalar field, spin zero. No spin indices, no Lorentz indices. So they are going to be somehow special. Okay, so now if we write what is this action, it's just the operator here, the Fadiev Popov operator D times covariant D applied to C and then sandwiches with C bar. So this action is just integral of a D4x over Minkowski space of C bar A of x times delta AB. Well, I can write this as C. Delta AB minus delta. I think there is a minus delta for some reason, times CB of x plus, that's the first term, and then you have C bar A of x times epsilon ABC remove this zero mode times d mu c bar a of x. You see, I have a d mu, but I can integrate by part and move, apply the d mu operator onto c bar a of x times a. So I have a d mu with an index mu up, a mu b of x, cc of x. Okay. So this is the action for the host field. And yes?
So there's two C bars.
Pardon?
There's two C bars in the last term, and there's one
C. There is two C bars because. Yeah.
And there's only one.
No, I'm sorry. Yeah. So because this C bar is there. Yeah. Sorry. Thank you. Okay. Yeah. So you can rewrite by just a bit of integration parta the term like that. And you see that now you have a path integral which is dA, the usual Liang-Mill actions. This here. And. So you have a path integral that I can rewrite in 2 minutes. Integral d of a, integral d of c bar and c, and I have this delta of f of a, which is a gauge fixing term for the gauge field, times exponential of I times the Young-Mills action for the gauge field plus the ghost action for C bar, C, and A. And that's it. So that's the new path integral, and you have everything represented in terms of path integral in the same way that if you, in QED, you can quantize QCD by a path integral where you have an integrate over the Maxwell field and you have a path integral over the Dirac fields, anti-commuting Dirac fields, psi and psi bar. Here you have gauge field and C bar. Okay, and we have everything. We have the, we can apply the Feynman rule. So what are the, now we can quantize and look at perturbation theory. And I think two lectures ago, I showed you what are the perturbation rules for the gauge field. For the gauge field, you have the propagator for the gluon field. Okay. And you have vertices, interaction, and vertices like that. And by a proper rescaling of A, this has a factor G, and this has a factor G squared, where G is the charge of the bosons, the unit of charge, the coupling constant. So this is the Feynman rules for the, and I wrote them explicitly. Basically, the propagator for the gluon is the same propagator as the propagator for the photon, except that you have the gluons, you have gluons with carry induces A, B is A, goes from 1, 2, and 3. Remember, because you have three different kinds of charges. So yeah. But the gluons here propagate by A equal A. Here you can have a mixing, so this AA. Here you have A, B, C, and we have seen that in fact for SU2, A, B, and C has to be different. So if you have one here, you can have two here and three. And here you can have A, and I think that you necessarily have AA and BB, okay, which have to be different. Okay? And then with some complicated group, some more complicated group factors and the interaction, in fact, the gluon carry also has an helicity. Yes?
The ghost action will be of order, will contain order G, or
I'm going to show that now. Now for the ghost. First, you see the ghost as a quadratic term, which is the same for the gauge field. So the ghost, let me rewrite the ghost like that. So the ghost, in fact, you go from C to C bar. So it's like the fermions. So the ghost, you can go from C A to C bar A. You see? So the ghost carry a charge, but the propagator is the same than for the scalar field. If you want, you have a delta AB. So the charge of the ghost that goes 1, 2, 3 are conserved against the propagator of the ghost. So this is the propagator of the ghost. Of the ghost. It's the same than from the scalar field. It has no spin. Okay, so this is the propagator. Now, what about the interactions? The interactions are contained in this term, and you see that the ghost interacts with the gauge field because it carries charges. And so you have an interaction vertex like this, C, C bar A. Okay, and the ghost carry an C, so you have, if you want, well, with my notation, you have here C, here you have B, and here you have A. You see? And, well, when you do that, you rescale A into GA, remember. So the A rescale to GA, so there is a factor G. You see? And then you have the factor epsilon ABC. See? So if you have a ghost with charge 1, the gluon must have charge 2, and the outcoming ghost has charge 3. So there is a charge
changing interaction.
So the ghost as a charge, carry charges, and that's why it interacts with a gluon. And in addition, there is a momentum P. So you have a d mu. So in fact, if you have a momentum K, P, and Q here, incoming momenta and outgoing momenta, this factor has a Q bar mu, because the moment the gluon, of course, carry helicity. So the
here the mu and nu, is it the same as the polarization for the
what?
QED? The mu nu's, is it the same as the polarization for QED?
Yes, it's the same as QED. The difference with QED is that the boson have charge, the gauge boson have charge, so they interact. The photon is neutral, so it doesn't interact with itself. But it can interact with a charged particle. Okay. So this is an interaction that doesn't change the helicity of the ghost, because it has no helicity, but still, there is an interaction between the polarization of the gluon and the momentum of the... Okay. Good. So there are Feynman rules, and that's it. And of course, you have to remember, last thing, that the ghosts are fermions. Therefore, when you go to higher order loops, you have loops of ghosts. And the loop of ghosts carry a minus sign, exactly like the loops of fermions in QED. So fermions are ghosts, therefore you have anti-commuting relations. All these games about ghosts can be performed, I think, in canonical quantization. And in canonical quantization, the ghosts behave like scalar fields. So you have creation and annihilation operator for modes of the ghost, but they anti-commute instead of commuting.
Okay. Should that be a p mu there?
What?
In the ghost expression, p mu?
It's going to be a q mu, because you see the d mu applies to the C bar field, which is going there. So if you go from C bar A of X into C bar hat A of Q by Fourier transform, by integral dx, d4x, e I qx minus C bar A of X, the d mu C bar A of X gives an I minus I, well, that's minus I. Just this. Okay. Yes?
What happened to the epsilon ABC DAB term again?
It's there. The epsilon ABC is a symmetry factor for the interaction term between the ghost and the...
No, but we had two terms. One where the derivative acted in something and...
Well, the epsilon is in front of everything. It's the same epsilon for AD and for DA. So here you have a epsilon. There is a factor, there is a charge, and then there is a symmetry factor, epsilon A, B, C.
Yeah, sorry, but in one of the terms, the derivative acts on the ghost, and in the other, the derivative acts on the gluon. So
no, they both are. No, it's just that I've rewritten, I have performed integration by parts. So you can rewrite C bar D of C. I'm being very schematic here.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. You see, I can rewrite this as minus D C bar times D C. I just integrate by part. It's very schematic, but that's what I'm doing. And therefore, here you have a D applying just on C bar. Not just.
Yes, because there's a product rule there, right? Huh? Like there's the derivative not only acts on A, but also acts on the C that.
In this expression, the E here acts on, well, in the above, the first expression, let me, and here, the D acts on C, and here the D acts on B and not of C. That's why I put parentheses. That was a bit fast. But think about, if you think in this notation, in fact, this notation is very compact, but it tells you what to do. Okay, so it's just what I did. Okay, so let me just perhaps finish by one sentence. So we have the perturbation rules for gauge theory on the example of SU2, but all this machinery works for any gauge group. And so in the next lecture, I will not discuss gauge theories. Well, I will discuss another aspect of gauge theories, which is very important, which is the X mechanism. We agreed with Dan about that. And I will come back in discussing some aspects of the physics of gauge theories in a more qualitative way. I will not doing much calculation, but you can already guess that. I will just show you the basic idea. If you are interested in, higher order, so you see, if you are interested in what is the propagator of a gluon, I'm just taking the propagator of the gluon. For the photon, it's simple. For quantum electrodynamics, if you have no Dirac field, the propagator of the photon is just the ordinary propagator. At all orders, you may have. But now for gauge theories, we have interactions. So we have term of order g squared, and you can think about what are the propagators. You can have this. Let's be interested into the irreducible function. You can have this, you can have this. I think that's all what we can have. But now you can also have a virtual loop of ghosts. Okay. So all of these terms are of order g squared. Because here there is g, here there is g squared, here there is g and g. But the ghosts are fermions. So there is a minus sign. Okay. And that's it. And in fact, so of course, the combinatorics is much complicated because you have the group symmetry factors, you have the momentum because these vertices and these vertices depend on the momenta. So it's a bit of algebra that you find in all good books like Peskin and Schroeder who make the calculation precisely. And the point is that if you had not taken this into account, you would have had troubles, a lot of troubles. You would have troubles with unitarity. For instance, there is a coupling between the transverse polarization and the longitudinal polarization of the photons, which does not sum out to zero if you consider only this diagram and these diagrams. And you have also a problem with renormalization. You have ultraviolet divergences of these diagrams, which do not behave properly. Okay, but I'm going to discuss that on Friday. And the point is that these new diagrams are also trouble for the same reason, but they cancel, basically. Because of the minus sign, you have cancellations. And that's very schematic. You are both unitarity and renormalizability of the quantum theory are ensured because you have fermions. So it's just a storytelling. And it's the same for other diagrams that we'll discuss a bit on Friday. So thank you. Let me stop here. I just gave you a flavor of quantization of gauge theories, but this picture of having Fadiyev-Popov determinant and ghost is something very important, which is important in other theory too, and even in non-condensed matter. So on Thursday, we'll discuss the Higgs mechanism, and on Friday, we'll come back to gauge theories. Okay, thank you.